All right, I'll start over again. So I'm here actually also in my role representing the Spirit of 1848 Caucus, of which I'm chair, and we formed in 1994. And PLN was actually very vital in our caucus as well. And the fact that she was in our caucus, in the Women's Caucus, in Medical Care Section, and in Socialist Caucus, which is what we all are up here at the table, spoke to how PLN very much saw in her role, she was someone who actually was primarily involved in health services research. And she was concerned with how injustice translates into health. And she was concerned with making the connections, and that's why she was involved in all the caucuses she was. And what I think is really important that comes across in these different presentations are what the connections are and what the vision is that we have that makes these connections manifest. Because if we are separately doing our different struggles and our different analyses, if we have people that are doing the analysis, as Ellen was pointing out, of what's going on with structural adjustment over here, and somehow women's health is over here, and somehow racism is over here, and somehow something else is over there, and we don't actually have the space in our minds to understand what the fundamental connections are about power, and about privilege, and about property, and about who is holding on to what they have now and excluding others from that, we're not going to make the connections we need to make the strategic decisions we need about the kinds of battles that we fight. And so it's from that perspective that I want to offer some comments on what I've heard today. And also as someone who, myself, I'm actually not directly involved in struggles around healthcare. I'm someone who in my own work is focused more as a social epidemiologist on social determinants of health, understanding that healthcare is absolutely part of that, lack of access is part of that, but are the other conditions of people's lives, of work, of employment, of all these other aspects, of racism, of environmental pollution, of all these other aspects that we've talked about, of neighborhoods under assault with regard to the changes in the tax codes and all the rest, that's all part of what we think about. So I'm giving these as a friendly comment from someone who is outside watching some of what's gone on with the struggles around the provisions of healthcare and what happened in the healthcare reform battles. And I think the comments that I want most to come across is that, one, absolutely there has got to be a critical, inclusive left perspective that's very loud, because what we are faced with is a strong attempt that has been successful, particularly since the 1980s, in having a corporate-dominated approach to what we understand of the polity. That basically we're all supposed to somehow turn into consumers, that we're all supposed to be partners with corporations or with business entities, that is the motivating force, not issues of care, not issues of compassion, not issues of solidarity, not issues of justice. And if we're not making noise about any of this, it's only going to get worse. I think that's just, I don't think there's a shortcut on this, and I don't think that it's easy, and I think that there have been many movements that have been struggling with exactly these issues. Because in our 1848 sessions, we were having a theme this year about co-optation. All of a sudden, we have social determinants of health becomes a new buzzword. We have social justice being the theme of this conference. What does that really mean? And the thing is that if there's not backlash, it means you haven't been pushing forward. And what we're having is a lot of backlash, and we've had continued backlash to what were the gains of the period that comes before when the Hyde Amendment happened, that were gains to the period where came before and were part of why Medicaid and Medicare happened in the 1960s, around the people's movements, around poverty, around anti-poverty, obviously, around medical care, around civil rights, around self-determination. So we're in a period of having to try to move and pick up where there's been intensified backlash against things that were gains of an earlier period. And that's a political reality. Doesn't mean we're going to win on what we're going forward on, but if we can't frame things that way, we're going to be further hindered. So it means knowing our history, not just the past history of the past 10 years, or the past 20 years, or the past 30 years. We need a longer-term historical perspective, because otherwise we think we've only been on the defensive. And that's actually not true. And I think what's really interesting is that we were having in one of our sessions yesterday, you know, a reminder of what happened with the Alma Ata, 1978, 2 years before we have Reagan, Thatcher, and all come in, where we're having a call for actually true primary health care, not selective primary health care, but true primary health care, and with an attention to, in fact, women's lives and women's needs in that process, with an attention to understanding that actually reproductive health is, I don't know, how else did any of you get here in this world? Might just be sort of fundamental. So I think these kinds of connections really are critical to make. And I think that if we can't articulate this, we've really got a problem. But it doesn't mean that we get to win. It doesn't mean that we get to not have to make important kinds of strategic compromises in going forward, but naming them as such and keeping that bigger vision out there. I wish there were a way to say there was a shortcut. I'd like to say that in addition to the questions of stigma and class, that we also have to understand in the US context how racism is completely imbricated in all of that. Because if we don't, and we don't understand at the same time that there's not only been all these questions about the right to abortion, but where sterilization abuse has been, who's been prevented from having children, that has to become part of the discussion as a balance and saying, what's the conditions of the world into which we're bringing these children? So I think that these are parts that have to be addressed. And I think in terms of the constructive tensions between what Martha and what Ellen were saying about where at the same time is being also clear in political forces, because frankly, the single payer arguments didn't work. They didn't win. They didn't build enough of the base. And there's the same problems of what's the fragmentation and what's the disconnects that didn't happen to make that argument get out there more. But what was also clear was that there was a clear statement, this is how Ali Fine, who I see here, was able to get in, was because the demands were made. That this is a governance that we have right now, particularly with the Obama administration, which is not going to step forward unless seriously pressed. And it's taking the FDR argument that much more forward. And actually, Eleanor was rather key in that argument, shall we say. So it's not only an FDR argument. And just to translate for those of you who are not thinking history past, we're talking the 1930s here, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt being really key. And then I just got an email today from a colleague who does work in health and human rights, who said that actually, very interestingly, the UN just passed a very major statement about the US's lack of compliance with many aspects of human rights, with all the conventions that we haven't signed, with what the problems are with regard to the way that we have racial profiling and incarceration of huge masses of populations of color, which ties completely to these questions of where do prisons fit into the system. This is the systems of accountability that we need to raise our sights and get out of just the frame of what we are so embattled in only in the US to remember and remind people in the US that we're part of the global world. And that there are other countries that actually have way better policies than we do, have way better provisions, have way better just basic expectations of what it is to be human and have human rights. And that has to be part of our discourse. And if we in the US don't get up to speed on talking about that, we're only going to be that much more entrenched in our internal divisions. So I am offering no easy solutions. I am offering no easy compromises between what was said and the conditions and concerns raised. But I am suggesting that if we don't start thinking about what these connections are and tie it to our political economic systems, and it's not just one form of capitalism, because capitalism has done many different things in many different times, and the forms of imperialism and how they've looked have looked at different times and different places. But if we're not making these connections to what's happening in our economy with control, with the people that want to keep control, you look at the demographics of who the Tea Party is, for example, we're talking predominantly white and wealthy people as the major source, and we're also having to talk about where, again, the role of corporations are, yes, in the media, but also in distorting science. There's a new book that's just come out called Merchants of Doubt, which looks at how the right-wing foundations and corporations have funded selected scientists to produce doubt. I mean, remember, again, Philip Morris had the great line that doubt is our product. If we can have doubt, we'll prevent regulation, and makes it very clear that there's a Cold War logic and a pro-capitalist logic that is absolutely about the continued theme of free market fundamentalism. That the way that Philip Morris wanted to frame things is regulate smoking, that's the first sign, you're going to go down that slippery slope and you're going to regulate everything and have socialism. I could point out a few countries that have different smoking rates that have similar economies, but hey, that's not really supposed to be part of this kind of discussion of being somewhat rational about some of the evidence. So I think the thing is that if we're not keeping clear that we're going to actually have to embrace and deal with this issue of what is the role of government, and that has this fundamentally a political question about our economy as well as our rights, we're not going to be equipped to take on what the divisions are that are being discussed here. So I'm not going to, again, suggest any easy solutions, but in listening to this conference over the past few days, looking at what happened with the midterm elections, looking interestingly even at my own state in Massachusetts, where Governor Patrick actually did win, even though we have our Senator Brown as well, that a major difference was there was a remember, oops, right, we have to get out the base. Yeah. And so Boston voted. Boston barely voted in the election around Brown. The base was not turned out. The suburbs voted. So if we are not geared in that kind of way and not supporting those efforts, we will be that much more in their rear. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. I don't think anyone will leave here today with easy answers, but certainly with a great panoply of ideas, many of which hopefully are becoming synthesized. We have one more discussant, Kumanan Rasanathan, and I'll ask you to come up here and introduce yourself. Thanks.
Thank you, Ellen. Vanakkam, kia ora koutou, good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to follow such illustrious speakers, and I actually think, if I think of my public health career, coming after Nancy Krieger is both very exciting and slightly a suicidal thing to do. So, so bear with me. I'll try not to keep you from what you really want to do, which is ask these people questions. I'm a Sri Lankan Tamil New Zealander who lives in Switzerland, and I'm a bureaucrat. I work for the World Health Organization. And I suppose we work within the system. That's our job. There have been times of my life where that's not what I've done. And I wear two hats, I suppose, in this, and I'd like to briefly make some comments from the basis of those hats. I worked on the World Health Report two years ago on it's called primary healthcare, now more than ever. I was lucky enough to be one of the writing group in that. And then I was also a member of the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health, one of these buzzwords that we talk about. And so I'm also an outsider. I'm one of those people who gets bemused, you know, when you talk about American healthcare, and all the Americans I know are like you guys, right? And then if we say, I mean, health systems are a social determinant, buzzword, which means health systems represent our societies. We create them. They reflect the struggles, the prejudices, the stigmas, the way we are. And health reform, I think, if you look at all of the struggles that I've studied, they reflect, I think, the impulse of the way we want our societies to be. They reflect what we aspire to, the way we see ourselves. And so they come about from political struggle. I mean, if we look at progressive health reform movements all over the world, they're the histories of political struggle. Now, as a technocrat, I mean, often I think we obscure that sometimes. We talk about guidance for health system strengthening, or we talk about, well, yes, what is the most cost-effective way to do this? But deep down, there's a strong ideological base. It's about values, and there's conflict of those ideas. But beyond that, because there's about conflict of ideas, it's not enough just to have those values. We also need those political strategies, which have been talked about today, about how do we solve those conflicts with people who disagree with us. And I have to say for myself, I mean, we looked at healthcare reform, and yes, I know that WHO ranked the system 37th and got in a lot of trouble for doing that in 2000. But most of the time you just think, oh, well, this is actually what is American exceptionalism, because it is true that in the rest of the world, in rich countries, you organise your system so people have access to healthcare. And people just think that. I grew up in New Zealand, but my parents come from Sri Lanka, and my mother, who grew up in a little village on an island off the north of Sri Lanka, she had access to the healthcare she needed, right? It's a very poor country. So you look at the US and you think, gosh, how does that happen? And I have to admit, often you think, well, that's an abstract thing. There's lots of clever people in the US, so I'm sure they'll sort that out. Now, recently, I married an American, or she married me, one of the two. And so she didn't have health insurance. It staggered me. I was like, you don't have health insurance? How did that happen? She now has health insurance because she's married to me. She's covered under the WHO health insurance, which covers you. What? It staggers me. She is, by any definition, I mean, she comes from a working class Michigan background, from a small town in Michigan, but she has an elite education, taught by some of the people here, actually, and yet she doesn't have health insurance. How does that happen? So that makes it a little bit less abstract for me. And then on the way here, my wife is actually in Michigan at the moment. I was flying from Detroit to here, and the guy next to me happened to identify with the Tea Party. And I'd never met anyone like that before, because I only know, I live in Le Boule, I only know, you know, American liberals. And so we had a very interesting conversation about the role of government in the state and about healthcare. So it was a really good primer for this. And he just told me, well, governments don't work, you know, and we've just got to get the government out of healthcare. Leave it to the doctors. And I said, you know, I'm a doctor. I know doctors. You shouldn't leave it to the doctors. Right? Doctors are very important and important members of our health workforce, but they're only part of the solution. And I said, but look at all these countries. That they have government and it works and they have better performance, better quality. This is what I do. This is my job, right? And they have better outcomes, they're more cost effective, and it's run by the government. And you guys, you know, spend the most and have terrible outcomes. Even for rich people, you have worse outcomes. And he said, oh yeah, but they rigged their data. And I said, okay. And then he said, oh, but finally it said, well, these are functional countries, I was saying. And he said, oh yes, but they don't pay for their defense. And then I said, well, sometimes your defense expenditure doesn't work out so well either, does it? And then he lost it. I mean, he shouted at me for 10 minutes at the end of the flight, right? And that was very good for me. Because I think the reason it's good for me is it's actually about the realities of the societies you live in. And if all you do is talk to your own, you know, in the bubble, it's about how you're engaging. So then, you know, it's giving me that understanding. So I don't have any easy solutions. But if we look at the other histories of struggle, why has Brazil progressed over the last 30 years? What was that group post the dictatorship, the end of military rule? That group of activists deeply involved in the broad political struggle that led to the SUS, that then led to the Programa Saúde Familiar, that struggle to increase coverage. What has happened in all sorts of countries? What happened in my own country, New Zealand, that led to a welfare state? Those are broad political struggles which took many years, and with people making that fight to articulate their ideas, but linked to broader struggles, which then I think leads me, I mean, we said in the World Health Report, you need universal coverage, you need to orient care around people, you need public policies that protect health, and you need leadership that can guide this and can negotiate through this very complicated landscape we have at global and national levels. But what all of that means is it's in the political context we're in, and we've got to accept that we are in a time when even in those countries that so supposedly have universal coverage, the tide is coming back. And so I'll say two final things, is that when you focus on healthcare reform with all of this energy, or when you focus for these fundamental rights of women, the other thing to consider is the broader system. Are we talking about a model of healthcare that's fit for the 21st century, right? And are we, because when we look at what's driving those other countries to retreat sometimes, you're talking about aging populations, chronic disease, our pharmaceutical model. So even if you get universal coverage under a single payer system, is it still going to be fit for purpose for the struggles you're going to face in the 21st century? And the second thing, put my social determinants buzzword hat on and to finish, you can get the best healthcare system in the world, and as many of you have already said, you're still going to have gross health inequities. You're going to have those social justice issues. And so the question is all the energy you put into healthcare reform, is that part of that broader effort to reform your society in the way that you want it to be? Or does it suck up all of that energy and then you get to the promised land and you wake up the next morning and you think, what did we actually achieve? Thank you.
Well, it's my hope that when we get to the health reform that we want, we will have addressed some of those issues, but I guess we're going to have to wait and see. You're certainly going to leave here, hopefully, more stimulated and motivated than when you came in, more sure of what to do, I don't know, but hopefully thinking you're going to do something. We're going to have Q&A, but I want to first ask Martha to come back and talk about a follow-up session where I think maybe she wants to continue this conversation.
Yeah, so, I think so.
Who would like to make a statement, ask a question? Please, Renee.
Actually to
no, just speak. Hmm? Speak up.
Oh, sorry. I wanted to direct my question to Cindy. And correct me if I didn't get the gist of what you were saying, but it sounds like you're saying that abortion, you need to get the emotional baggage, especially when we're using it in public debate, off the table. That we need to look at it more as what it is. It's another therapy. It's a choice. It's, you know, whatever. But, and the reason I'm wondering about this is, you know, of course the pro-choice movement has been having this mantra saying, well, abortion is the last resort, and we want as few abortions as we can have, which I've always disagreed with, because I think that's just a fallacy and we shouldn't, again, it puts more stigma on the issue. So is that what you're saying? Or?
Yes, it is. I wouldn't have led by saying take the emotion away because I don't think that's possible. And I think depending on how personal the conversation, the setting is for the conversation, you do get to really, you know, what does it mean to take a potential life and who should be able to make that decision. Not in every setting does that come, but that's an emotional thing to talk about. But the point that you got that I was trying to convey, and thank you for giving me a chance to expand on it a little more, is that abortions happen and they will continue to happen, and to be safe and to be most supportive of women's health, they need to be legal and easily accessible. And I completely agree with you that little experiment some people tried with trying to create a mantra, safe, legal, and rare, was inadvertently contributing to the fracturing. And there are some great thinkers who have challenged that head on, Tracy Wheats being one of them, who's here at this meeting. And we featured some of her work in one of our newsletters. But I think we just have to keep saying that it's a matter of women's health and that we can't fully support women's good health without including abortion when needed.
Great, thanks. Let me see a couple of, okay, over here, and then I think Martin. And why don't you say your name when you
I'm start? Mary Abram. And Cindy, I didn't understand, and maybe I missed something, what you were saying about abortion as a pre-existing condition.
No, it's contraception. She got it.
By 2014, in the exchanges, everyone will be able to get health insurance either through their own dollars or with a subsidy, or if they are even poorer, through Medicaid. No one of any age, any situation could be denied coverage through because they have a pre-existing condition. Temporarily, until we get there, each state has to either set up on its own or allow the federal government to set up a pre-existing condition health plan. And even though no law required him to, President Obama issued an executive order preventing abortion from being covered in those pre-existing condition plans that will exist for 3 years, then sunset out. Does that, yeah, thanks for giving me a chance to clarify what I should have been clearer about. Just on that.
It's complicated. Martin.
Yeah, Martin Donato, California's Canada. I have a question and a comment. The question is, I think that what you're doing is great, and I'm wondering how far your campaign is extending. Because I can imagine something for television or print magazine with a variety of individuals from all religions, all races, saying, I am a Protestant church grower, and I had an abortion. Mm-hmm. Have you tried to do that, and what sort of pushback have you gotten from the media? That's my question. I just want to make a quick comment. I was really inspired by all the speakers, and I think you're right in saying this is a battle, and we should not be compromising. I don't think that those who eliminated slavery in this country, the abolitionists said, well, let's eliminate slavery, but only for certain groups. The ones who got rid of child labor said, well, let's get rid of child labor as long as it's during the day and not at night. The suffragists didn't say, let's get women to vote, but only women who are educated. This is a fight. We can't compromise.
Why don't you? Do you want to repeat?
The quick answer, Martin, is I don't know the answer. I don't think anyone's had the money yet to try to bring that kind of campaign to the media, but I see someone who wants to try it who may know.
So I want to say a couple of people want to respond. I'll be quick, and David, you'll be next, and then Nancy wants to speak. You know, I think it's really, and I'm not sure exactly what you meant, Martin, by not compromising, if you meant never compromise any, in any way at all about anything. I think, so,
well,
so let... Sorry?
It came out perhaps more strident, as I meant to
imply. Well, that is probably true around too much. I just want to point out that it took a while to get rid of slavery, and there were stages in that fight. There were freed slaves in various states, and there was finally quite a contentious and bloody war, I think, along the way towards having unions and having the weekend off. There were years during which we fought to make sure that there was no child labor, and we had bloody struggles to make sure that we had unions. I think we need to be militant, and we need to choose where we are in that spectrum, but it's not that simple. Nancy.
Yeah, I'd also just like to follow up on what Ellen is saying here, because I think it's really important that we never sanitize our history. And in fact, for example, on the what happened with the vote was there actually were very important schisms, and there was a whole sector of the white women's movement that wanted to get the vote that was perfectly content to not have black populations get the vote, and they're actually very annoyed and angry and mobilized about the fact that black men initially got the vote as part of what happened after the Civil War, and how could those people be allowed to vote and not us? So I think it's really important that we not sanitize what the history is when we appeal to history to ground our struggles. And I think on the point on compromise, what I want to also really affirm is that what Ellen was describing, for example, are ways in which to defend what has gone forward as inadequate but has good features but is also necessary, but bringing it back to this question, because it's really critical, of what is the role of government vis-a-vis people's lives and also the economy. Because if we don't make those connections, it becomes like your Tea Party discussion, and we don't see where government plays this role. But it's not like all government is always great government. We have, as also is pointed out with regard to Brazil, things like dictatorships, for example. It's not that you want just government, it's what kind of government. And it's what kind of government with regard to participatory democracy and its true meaning. So if we talk, and that means also economic democracy, and some people would go so far as to call some of that socialism, but then we can get into many hair-splitting arguments as to what is or isn't socialism. But the point is about, with this regard, is being clear about what kind of defense of government in terms of people's civic participation in the decisions that matter for how we live our lives, not having what's just happened right now, for example, with regard to the campaign money, where corporations can buy votes to a whole new level. Where we're seeing again the fears and concerns of going to oligarchy and plutocracy being realized because of what these latest changes have been. And the only counter to money, power, and concentration of wealth, and what happened in part with the very bloody war that you're talking about with regard to the Civil War, was actually its people power. There's never been any other substitute for that, organized around a vision fundamentally premised on the equal human dignity of all.
I want to finish every presentation with Nancy standing up and saying what Ellen meant to say. David, please. No, really. No? Somebody else want to speak?
Well, I just want to be clear. I'm not meaning to stand.
Say it up.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm well aware of the history of those events. What I was implying was that there was always a driving force of a small group of people who weren't willing to compromise. Who said, let's get the vote for everybody. Let's get rid of child labor for everybody. It's not meant to sanitize the history, but there does need to be a group of people who are saying, this is what we want. We want single payer for everybody. And I think it's the people in this room that are going to be doing that. Because there are a lot of other people outside who are willing to say, well, we'll take single payer for this group or that group.
Well, we could, and I'll let Martha get a lick in.
Yeah, the thing about that small group demanding single payer is, and the reason that I'm standing here and that we'll be in room 601 at 4:30, is we really need to make that small group a little bigger. And part of how to do that I addressed in my remarks about there's a real difference between tactics and strategy on the one hand and compromising with your your own vision on the other hand. I just wanted to make a comment to Dr. Viswanathan about how, of course, once you get health care reform, there's all that social inequity left over. Of course, that's not how it works. It's a dialectical process, because in the course of demanding equitable health care, what one does, and one of the two, there's two reasons we don't have single-payer health care in this country. One is power, that the forces that own about 20% of the economy don't want us to have it. The other piece is vision, and that is what Tony Mazzocchi used to talk about when he said, if we got health, got really truly equitable health care, that would open a window on the social wage. If we can have health care, by golly, we can have better schools, we can have housing for all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what the powers that be really need us to think is, remember what Thatcher used to call TINA, there is no alternative. What we've got is absolutely the best things can be. Well, we know that's not true, and we also know what Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand, it never has and it never will.
To the panelists and our discussants, and to all of you for being here. Really appreciate it.